The world is changing at breathtaking speeds, with trends and fads popping up and passing away at breakneck pace. Against that backdrop of nearly constant upheaval, we welcome you to the Sunday Scotch Society. Over delectable, sumptuous scotches and with the occasional good cigar in hand, we have open, honest, and uninhibited conversation about whatever strikes our fancy. Whether it's the critical issue of the day or a deep dive down the rabbit hole, we take it all seriously while having a good time. Join us for a stiff drink and a great conversation. Good day to you, Matthew. Thank you for agreeing to continue this journey into the land of whiskey in all of its incredibly variegated splendor. Today, we continue our journey to some kind of conclusion about one of the most important third spaces in a community, the library. And along the way, I will be sharing with you some thoughts on Japanese whiskey. And I'm looking forward to sharing those thoughts. But it occurs to me, Matthew, that I may have chosen to, I may have chosen to begin this particular pod episode in a fashion that does not tell people who and what we are. And I ask that those who are journeying along with us forgive me for my hubris in thinking that you know what you're listening to and you know why. So let me properly begin by saying, hi, Matthew, and the listener. My name is K. Quincy Parker, and you are tuned in to the Sunday Scotch Society, where we have a conversation about whatever strikes our fancy, and where we lubricate that conversation with a sampling of whatever whiskey we may choose to explore. We have a list that we are excited about. Not every whiskey, in fact, very few whiskeys end up on the list. The list is, I think it's at four. Today's episode, like I say, we're going to talk about libraries, and I'm going to talk about Japanese whiskey. But that's me, Matthew. Why don't you introduce yourself and tell us what you're going to talk about while I talk about Japanese whiskey?
Well, so happy to be on the show today. Looking forward to hearing your thoughts on Japanese whiskeys, and just very happy to be able to shoot down any propositions that you have today.
Yay.
It's my pleasure.
I'm well aware that that is a thing in which you take quite a lot of pleasure.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Cool. I haven't named the Japanese whiskey that I'm going to be drinking today. I suspect that our fellow journeyers, our fellow travelers, our fellow dipsomaniacs will be interested to see which Japanese whiskey I'm talking about. But I would like to know, before I start with that, which whiskey you will be discussing, sir.
I'm actually going to be having whiskey that is probably familiar with the listener, because I have a little famous grouse that I'm going to talk into today.
You sneaky little bum.
Hey, you're doing blends, right?
Yes, I am.
There we go.
Okay, well, there it is. One of the things about blends, blended whiskey, is that it is, first of all, most whiskeys are blended in some way. Even single malt whiskeys are actually blended. What single malt really means is that all of the whiskeys that are going into the blend are from the same distillery. And so what the master distiller will do in case of a single malt whiskey, they'll pick the best or the ones that have the flavor profile and the age profile that they're looking for among the whiskeys in their distillery, and create a spirit that represents what it is they're trying to capture. But blended whiskeys are usually not quite as character driven as single malt whiskeys, which usually means that they have a greater tendency towards sweetness, towards balance, towards maybe even a little more fruitiness than your traditional single malt whiskey. And one of the things that I really enjoy about the world of whiskey is how different distillers look after their spirits and try to create something that expresses not just the distillery, but the place, the locale. In wine, they call it terroir, you know, how the slate stony ground gives a minerally flavor to the wine, and how high elevation makes a wine a little more acidic, and how low elevation, you know, it's the influence of place on the spirit that is produced. And Japanese blended whiskeys, which are a lot older than I think most people who are coming to whiskey in this, let's call it, modern era.
Older than we would think. I am one of the people who thought that Japanese blends, at least in terms of popularity, is fairly recent.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? You're right when you qualify it. It is a fairly recent phenomenon that Japanese whiskeys are as popular as they may be among, let's say, a more widespread audience. But people who are drinking scotch for a fairly lengthy period of time will tell you that Suntory whiskey goes all the way back to the founding of Hong Kong, and even perhaps before. So it's like it's a very old tradition of whiskey making. And Japanese whiskey is considered one of the most sought after categories of spirit, I guess you would say, in the world. You know what I'm saying? It's strictly regulated as well. There's an association called the Japan Spirits and Liquor Makers Association, Liqueurs Makers Association. And they regulate what people who are distillers are allowed to call whiskey in Japan. So we're talking about something that is particularly quality driven. And to me, that makes it a very sort of special experience. And I love that about the Japanese whiskeys, especially. And the typical sort of character and style of a Japanese whiskey, which I guess would come back to the Suntory, like I mentioned, is, you know, they usually have a really sort of pronounced blend of honeysuckle, of orange, of toffee. So you get your citrusy, candy, herbaceous notes. That's kind of what you should expect from a Japanese whiskey. The first one that I tried was a bottle of one of the Suntory blends, and it really hit all of those, I guess, markers. And at the time I was on a kick where I only drink single malt, and it was really the Japanese it was the Suntory whiskey that really sort of turned me back onto blends and drinking blended whiskeys with an expectation that they are just as fine as any single malt whiskey. So I'm excited about the whiskey that I'm going to be trying today. The fact is, this is one that I have never tried, so I'm especially looking forward to it. It's the Muteki Japanese whiskey. It is finished in Mizunara oak, and I'm excited because, like I say, it's a new one for me, and I'm curious to see if the difference in the type of oak that is used to finish this particular whiskey will be pronounced enough that I can taste the difference and I can tell. And so I'm looking forward to that in a big way. The name Muteki means without enemy, and it's a tribute to the warrior women of medieval Japan, who in the name of their freedom were able to commit the forbidden. I suppose that means take up arms and fight. And so it's really cool. The label has a picture of a woman, a samurai. I think it was the label that made me pick it up, to tell you the truth, because I think that I was born a samurai right around the time of the fall of the shogunate. So like at the very end of the samurai era, I believe that that's how I lived my last life, if I had a last life. And so this picture on this label spoke to me in a very, very real way. So I'll post a picture of that on my social medias, and we'll post it on the show social so that folks can see it. And, I'm really looking forward to it.
Awesome.
Are we ready then?
I thought you were going to go in with the nose.
Well, then let's do it. I just making sure you ain't got nothing else you wanted to say before we jump in, bro. All right.
I want to know how this tastes, man.
All right. Well, I guess in service of not drawing things out any longer than we have to, because I know I'm excited and interested and curious, I will do the thing. Oh, wow. Oh, my goodness. Right away, even as I'm pouring it into the glass, that maybe it's the influence of sort of knowing what the style of Japanese whiskey is. But the first thing I smelled was caramel and toffee, you know, that cooked sugar flavor and aroma that you get. It's like really rich, you know, that really super sweet crumbly toffee. That's the kind of aroma I get right away. The next thing I get is the alcohol. It's not burning my nose at all. Even if I go in really close and stick my nose in the glass, which generally you're not supposed to do, I do get a bit of the citrus. I do get some of the herbaceousness, but The overall sense that I get on the nose of this is that toffee flavor, well, aroma, and it has the salivary glands doing some things. You know what I'm saying? I'm really looking forward to tasting this bad boy. Nice. Am going to delay my gratification in the service of you doing the thing on your side.
Oh yes, that is as delightful as the few months ago that I met her. Okay.
This particular bird is a she, I see. Okay.
It's a little floral, a little citrusy. That's surprising to me. Yeah, not a lot to say here. Just, I believe the last time that we spoke that I did admire the legs on it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Hints of caramel. That's what you would think of when you think of a Scotch, man.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm excited to just move straight into the sip, if you don't mind.
Please, go ahead.
Oh, that is such a pleasant sting. It's what you get from a very cinnamony peppermint, but without the flavor. I mean, there are mild, mild hints of that, but the sensation is really the thing that hits me right away. Overall, still to me, quite easy. I wouldn't call it soft necessarily, but it borders on being quite smooth, which, so it's not too alcohol forward, and it's only 80 proof. So, okay. For some reason, I thought my memory was telling me that it was a higher proof. And then that was somehow a surprise that it was as smooth as it was. Yeah. A hint of apple that I always get for some reason. I don't know if my palate is right or wrong around this, but just a little hint of peat. Just very pleasant, man.
Excellent. Excellent.
Oh, and I love that finish. How it just sort of builds. Good stuff.
Well, then I will not be left out of the ability to brag upon my tipple of choice. Here we go with my first taste of the Muteki Mizunara Oak Finish, blended Japanese whiskey. My goodness. That is what blended whiskey should taste like, brother. The crumbly, sweet toffee, caramel flavors that I anticipated from the nose definitely dominate this whiskey, with the citrus kind of providing the citrus is the major minor flavor. It's the main counterpoint to the sweetness from the toffee. And then there's a herbaceousness on the tongue as well. And it's almost as if all of that, remember I said the second thing that I got was the alcohol, but it seems like all the alcohol must have evaporated out of the glass, because there's almost no sting at all. I'm going to try this again just to make sure I'm not. Yeah. Wow. Ah, there it is. Okay. So if I leave my mouth open and let air flow in over the tongue as I am letting the finish happen, that's where you get the alcohol warmth around the edges of the tongue. But the main sensation that I'm getting is that really beautiful sweetness with just a hint of the citrus. It's like almost like tangerine. You know, usually the citrus notes in a good scotch, they can kind of vary between grapefruit and orange. More rarely like a lemon, like a Meyer lemon. But this has almost like a tangerine type of citrus. You know, bright and fruity, and a bit sharp, but not so sharp that it's like stabbing you. It's really beautiful whiskey. My goodness, yeah, Muteki Mizunara Oak Finish blended whiskey. This is beautiful, Matthew. I'm gonna have to save this bottle. So that you and I can enjoy this in person the next time we get together.
That is a plan.
Yes. So, wow. Okay. This is going to be great lubrication for this whole conversation on libraries, right? So our initial proposition, in this conversation was that third spaces are necessary, and that they do not seem to be prioritized in the Bahamas at the present moment. I presented a good bit of data that shows that the studies that have been done all seem to point to not only the necessity of these spaces, but a number of tangible benefits to the communities that embrace third spaces. Particularly, our focus has been on libraries. And today, what I want to do is pick up on, so the last time we talked about it, my question is, what the hell happened to libraries, right? And today what I want to talk about is, how would we reboot the public library here in the Bahamas? Initially, I suppose I'm thinking of Nassau Public Library, but as you've pointed out, you know, that's, it's a really small space. And I can't imagine that it is, it would be the ideal place to start a reboot of a public library system, just by virtue of the fact that I think it's too small. But it is, I guess on paper, maybe it's the flagship of our public library system. So maybe we could start there. I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, this depends on what your goals are and you know, what your short-term expected outcomes versus mid to long-term is. So it could start there, but, you know, probably a poor choice if you're doing a wholesale reboot.
Yeah, and my proposition is that a wholesale reboot is necessary, right? So here's where I'm starting today. Transforming an old library with outdated books into a modern, relevant space, I believe it's both feasible and based on the research and my own personal impression, I believe it's essential in the digital age. And I think that by expanding a library's role as a community hub and integrating things like digital resources, innovative programming, and social spaces, I think libraries can be made to assume a more critical role in the Bahamas. And I've looked at some strategies and sort of tried to gather some supporting data on how to achieve what I think of as a necessary transformation. And so I'm gonna jump in here and start with the idea of diversifying library collections with digital resources, because to me that seems like the obvious place to start. And under that rubric, I would start with providing ebooks and digital collections. So looking at what's going on in library development around the world, many libraries have adapted by offering ebooks, audiobooks, and access to digital databases. I'm going to talk a little more about digital databases in a bit. But a report from the Pew Research Center found that 43% of Americans ages 16 and older had used a library website or mobile app to access digital materials. And the conclusion drawn by that research was that expanding digital collections would allow users to access resources remotely, which makes the library accessible to more tech-savvy individuals. And I guess that's, to me, it seems like an obvious statement, but I was pleased to see that there was research that supported that conclusion, or that supported is the wrong word there, given our concern about confirmation bias. The conclusion of the research was that expanding these collections allows remote access to these resources and enables accessibility of library resources to individuals who are conversant with technology. And given that we continue to talk about how people these days are almost born as digital natives, I think that kind of accessibility is necessary. I'm sorry. Okay. What was that? What was that?
No, because there's an implication in the term digital native that they would have particular skills, right? And I think that's true of popular media, at least in its popular uses. But that doesn't mean that they have a skill set that is useful to their own development and prosperity.
I hear you, but I would argue that even if we take what you are saying as true, if we take it as a given, I believe the ability to adapt that skill set in the direction that you're talking about is far more readily available than to create such a skill set from scratch.
Yeah, so for sure. I can see that.
Okay, awesome. Ladies and gentlemen, you heard it first here on the Sunday Scotch Society. Matthew conceded a point. Next.
I'm in search of truth. Like, why would that be a thing?
Nah, I'm just messing with you, bro. Providing access to, and we're still under the rubric of diversifying library collections with digital resources in service of trying to figure out how to reboot libraries here in the Bahamas, right? So the next point of reference for me is providing access to online databases. The American Library Association reports that 77% of libraries provide free access to online research databases, which are often otherwise prohibitively expensive. You and I are not going to pay the hundreds of dollars or even thousands of dollars to subscribe to some of these databases. But by subscribing to these databases, the libraries are providing access to both up-to-date academic and research content and other content as well, right? And I looked at some of the more popular and useful digital databases that libraries commonly subscribe to. JSTOR, which of course, I mean, I know that a guy like you, you've used JSTOR a bunch, right? And it's a protected electronic archive of leading journals across many academic disciplines that provides text searchable, high quality PDF facsimiles of each journal article from a publication's inception up to the past 3 to 5 years. So that's an incredibly extensive catalog of journal articles available for searching and use in both academic and research contexts. There's another common sort of digital database. There's a bunch. Academic Search Complete is another one. Web of Science, which is a database used to measure, evaluate, and track scientific research. And this particular one contains scientific articles and other materials published in leading scientific journals. Then there's the APA Psych Info, which contains abstracts and citations for scholarly literature in the behavioral and social sciences. This one has 4.8 million records at the last count. Then there's PubMed, which is the National Library of Medicine's free searchable database. Again, supporting scientific and medical research, contains more than 37 million citations. There's ProQuest databases. There's the Business Source Complete. There's ERIC. So, I mean, the ability of a library to give access to this incredible treasure trove of research material, it's difficult to state what value that would have to both the educational and research communities. You agree, or am I off in Never Never Land here?
No, I broadly agree, but we'll see if I agree to the overall when we get there.
The next thing that I think we could do to reboot libraries, public libraries in the Bahamas, after looking at diversifying the collections with digital resources, I think this will speak maybe a little more personally to you, and that is to create maker spaces and technology centers, right? So many libraries are creating maker spaces, and we talked about this a little bit last week, where people are using cutting edge technologies like 3D printers, laser cutters, design software, right? These spaces are allowing people to learn new skills, to engage in creative projects, to collaborate. And a report by the Urban Libraries Council found that 34% of libraries in the U.S. have makerspaces, which have been shown to boost community engagement and foster innovation. And the other side of this is providing technology and digital literacy training. And here I found something by the International Federation of Library Associations and Institutions that shows that libraries are key players in closing the digital divide by offering free internet access, computer training, and digital literacy programs. And libraries with technology training programs, like the ones I've cited, have been shown to help people acquire essential skills for the workforce, which is especially crucial in low-income or underserved communities. I'm looking forward to your thoughts on using our library system, our public library system, to create maker spaces and technology centers. But apparently,
I have mixed feelings on this, right? Because the more you take away space for one thing, you know, the less that is for anything else. So on the flip side, though, there are a few places that these sorts of resources are available, and libraries today should be repositories of all sorts of information, not just, you know, the printed word and its digitization. However, right, a makerspace itself has a lot of different requirements if it's to be done well. And so I think without a concerted effort by the government to create dedicated makerspaces, the use of the library is extra important. But in a world where you could get a bigger, more equipped, not just for 3D printing, but, you know, okay, you have all the little tools and you have breadboards and you have, you know, all the electronic components and you have, you know, little nuts and bolts and this and that, and you have the space set up in such a fashion where you can have workshops for actually making stuff, right? If that world exists, even if there's just one or two, you know, on New Providence and one in the bigger populated islands, out islands. Yes, I said out islands. I don't mind calling them family islands, but they are out islands. I'm from one, so, you know, if you want to have a problem with that, go ahead, talk to a native like me, see how we feel about it. So, I prefer if a library is a hub, right? And so it has a little bit of that available, but there are going to have to be restrictions. Like, you don't want anybody coming in and printing parts for their car. I'm not saying that we shouldn't have access to do those things somewhere, but I don't feel that a library is the appropriate place. It should be centered around learning. In the case of a library, use would have to be restricted, right? And specifically to the context of learning, of education, and access to information, but not to come in and print parts for your fridge, your car, your whatever, right? Which are not necessarily things that would be banned in a full-blown makerspace. So I'm partially for it, but I'm not into taking an entire floor unless, like, okay, this is now a makerspace. I don't think that's the right use for it.
Well, I mean, I think that you are you're already sort of in the weeds, right? Firstly, we are conceptualizing a reboot of a public library system. If this is an idea that is taken seriously, and that it, that is something that we've agreed, or we do agree to do as a community, I cannot imagine that we are short of space in public buildings to take a floor for a makerspace. Sorry, I do not agree that there is necessarily if I give space to one thing, I'm taking space from another. I don't necessarily agree that that's true. I think that's true if we say that we're talking about the Nassau Public Library as currently located and constituted. But as we are talking, I am less and less confident that that is where a reboot of the public library system would start, because there's just plainly speaking, just not enough space. if it's there, then yes, you're 160% correct, and I agree with you 100%. But it can't be there because that's just not enough space, plain and simple. In my view, I'm probably wrong, but I'm going to be wrong saying it with my chest. So there it is. The first avenue of rebooting a library system, in my view, is to diversify the collections, particularly focusing on digital resources. The next, technology, creating makerspaces and technology centers. The next avenue for reboot for me is the one where I think as cultural actors, you and I will both have a fairly strong feeling about this, is hosting innovative and relevant programming. The first sort of bullet point under this heading would be lifelong learning programs. Libraries can become centers of lifelong learning by offering things like workshops and lectures, classes that teach practical skills. In this day and age, everybody and their cat is talking about coding. So libraries can have programs on coding classes. They can do resume building workshops, financial literacy courses to appeal to folks who are looking to improve their career prospects. One of the bits of research that I saw here is the Institution of Museum and Library Services, or IMLS, found that libraries offering adult education programs help people build critical skills and contribute to local economic development. And of course, anything that contributes to local economic development, in quotation marks, is bound to get public policy support. 'Cause I think that is one of the ways in which our public policy makers sort of see their main, let's say that they think that that's their main deliverable, is to increase people's economic prospects and to create a public library system where people are engaged and have access to lifelong learning programs, which have been shown to contribute to local economic development, I think is something that people can support and get behind. The next sort of bullet point here is engaging with the community through events. And as I mentioned, you know, living where I lived for however long I lived there, the number of author talks or film screenings, book clubs, cultural events that I was able to both go to myself, take my daughter to, you know, these things can turn a library into a cultural hub for a community. And I'm going to cite the Knight Foundation study again that found that libraries that host community-centered events saw increased foot traffic and became stronger community connectors. And engaging programming makes libraries more relevant to modern audiences by meeting their social and cultural needs. And the sort of the corollary to that, in my view, is more foot traffic to the library means businesses in the surrounding areas have an opportunity to benefit from a bigger, more versatile, more diverse customer base, or potential customer base anyway. And I think that's a very important corollary to point out and to focus on.
That's an interesting perspective there. And I don't think that it crossed my mind, but of course it's true that wherever you have concentrations of people, there's more of any variety of activities. And that sort of flow of resources, you know, around a community is important. So yeah, I like that one.
I'm going to attempt to maintain a level of calm, as you have agreed with a second point that I have made. I'm not going to comment on it any further.
There are points to come.
Yes, I know. So the next sort of big bullet point heading is promoting social interaction and civic engagement, which is, I think, maybe drilling down on the programming aspect of local libraries, right? So if we look at libraries as third spaces, which, again, generally speaking, We are referring to a neutral social environment outside of home and work where people gather and engage. Robert Putnam, who did some research on something called social capital, which emphasizes that spaces like libraries foster community bonds and civic engagement. And so libraries that emphasize that role, you know, hosting civic forums and discussions and local meetings, that community connectivity, I believe, must have positive benefits. I would leave it to the researchers and the social scientists to say what those benefits might be, but I cannot imagine that increasing that social connectivity will not result in something good. And to pick up a little more on the idea of increased foot traffic and whatnot, libraries can support things like business databases and networking events. So they can directly support local entrepreneurs and small businesses. Once again, the Kauffman Foundation, I mentioned a different part of this study in an earlier podcast, but that this study found that access to free business resources and mentorship programs helped entrepreneurs start new businesses and create jobs, which makes libraries relevant to local economic development, which we've already agreed is going to be probably priority one when a government entity is considering whether or not rebooting public libraries and trying to modernize them makes sense as a government expense, because there has to be a return to the community in order to justify whatever expense the government has to put out.
Okay.
My final big reason for rebooting these libraries comes back to digital literacy and addressing things like the digital divide, right? So free internet access is essential for education, job searching, civic participation. So through offering Wi-Fi, computers, and in some cases, I've even seen mobile device lending programs, which I cannot imagine would be something that we would be doing in the Bahamas right away, but it's something to shoot for, right? But doing these kinds of things can make libraries indispensable to communities that lack reliable digital access. And to specifically speak to digital literacy training, libraries can teach essential digital literacy skills, such as how to navigate online resources, how to protect personal data, and how to utilize technology effectively. And here I'm going to cite the Pew Research Center such study that showed people who were participating in digital literacy programs at their local library felt more confident in using technology, in improving their employment prospects, and in their ability to access services. I think that's incredibly important. And so my conclusion, after which I will hear your counter arguments, is that an old library with outdated books can become a vibrant modern resource by diversifying its offerings to include digital materials, things like makerspaces, technology training, and community-centered programming. And I think that by redesigning the physical space, by promoting social engagement, and by providing access to both print and digital resources, public libraries in the Bahamas can become relevant again and serve as essential hubs for education, innovation, and community building. I have not found any data or research locally on this, but the data and evidence that I've found from other communities consistently shows that libraries that adapt to modern needs not only survive, but thrive, and that they become indispensable to the communities they serve. And I believe that we can do that with public libraries here in the Bahamas if we as a community take the potential that libraries have for bettering our community seriously, and if we invest the community energy in pushing our public infrastructure to modernize and revolutionize our library spaces. That's my conclusion. I open the floor for counterpoints.
I don't know why you default to the idea of debate when really, in my mind, this is a conversation and we're just searching for the truth. So it's much closer to what would be called a dialectic. So I don't necessarily have counterpoints. I have different points of view.
So, but sorry, Matt, let me, before you continue,
I'm saying this not as a jab towards you, but it's so that the listener understands where I'm coming from.
Which is fine. And I wanted to make clear that I was, when I say the floor is open for counterpoints, I do kid you a lot about disagreeing with me, but that's not what I'm doing this time. I'm really saying that we're having a conversation about data, about research, about conclusions that may not be relevant to our local circumstance. And I have a view. But I'm curious about whether or not you can poke holes in the conclusion that I've drawn. And so it's not, I agree, it's a dialectic. But that's what I was saying when I say the floor is open for counterpoint.
Okay. So help me out with this, right? I have a vague shape of the ideas that I want to put forth and intermesh and, you know, sometimes make counterpoints to what you've said. What is a library in essence? Like, we understand where the term comes from, right? But therefore, like, what is a collection of books? What is it that a library is actually doing? Not necessarily what we need it to do these days, but like, what was its essence and purpose in the beginning of libraries?
That's a very good question, and I can answer it with my sort of personal view, and also we can talk about the objective definition, the subjective definition of what a library is, so to speak. If we, you know, we could look in a dictionary, whatever the case may be. But a library, in my personal view, without recourse to a dictionary, is a source of both a repository of knowledge and information, and a source of knowledge and information which is intended to be accessible to a community, however that community is defined, with the intention that the information collected and stored in this repository is to be beneficial to the community in which it is located, either through the provision of information, through the provision of context against which information can be understood, or through the increase of knowledge, so to speak. That's what I think a library is.
Okay. So yeah, I broadly agree with that. And here again, I want to bring up the concept that I did. I don't know if it was one or two podcasts ago, but in the series where I spoke of the difference between data and information and knowledge and wisdom, right? And so my personal stance is that we're not looking in most cases to just be collecting data. We're not even looking necessarily to just get information. What we want is knowledge. And I won't digress into too much of what that is, but I will say now that I follow Vervaeke's, John Vervaeke, conception of the four ways of knowing here, right? So there's the propositional, or, you know, basically knowledge around facts. This, you know, blue marlins live in the sea, the sky is blue, etc. And then there is procedural knowledge, or knowing how to do something, right? It's a matter of skills building, which, and again, all of this, it becomes very clear that you can't separate the body from mind in when you're discussing this, this the concept of knowledge, right? So you have the propositional, the procedural, and then you have the perspectival, right? Wherein all information is seen through a set of what I like to think of as lenses, filters, and most certainly a perspective, or a particular angle that I'm going to see things through, and my view is going to be blocked, and I'm not going to see a bunch of stuff necessarily through that. But it is very, very important for humans, and this is one of the knacks that we develop that make us who we are, to be able to have theory of mind and to be able to see what it's like from someone else's point of view or something else's point of view, to move our perspective outside of the one that we naturally have, right? So we got the procedural, the propositional, the procedural, the perspectival. And then the last one that he developed, though, is the participatory, right? That you can't, there are ways there of knowing that have to be through the participation in the actual act or state. So we already saw in the procedural that you can't separate out the body, but in the participatory, it's you not just that you can't separate out the body, but also you can't separate out your connection to anything else, and in particular, other beings, other people, right? So it's from this context that I would like to talk about my perspective on the libraries. I think that their main benefit is around this concept of knowledge and these four different ways of knowing. And I think usually we, when we think of libraries, before we get to the concepts that you put forth, which I think are libraries should be in this day and age, we only thought of the propositional. Here's a set of facts, you know, or this set of claims from somebody. This is knowledge. But, and the procedural is more like, okay, you went to school for that, or you went to some, you know, you entered an apprenticeship, et cetera, right? But I think that, that the other three ways of knowing are just as, if not more important. And I think that much of what you have put forth is in service of these ways of knowing. So the participatory, you know, it's about community. It's about perspective. The community is also about perspectival, right? Being able to come in and listen to a lecture on how someone else sees film, but also what the characters are feeling, or getting stories from people who, like, okay, if you were so lucky to have a lecture series and you have someone who escaped from North Korea, or, you know, someone who's just relating their growing up in the Family Islands, Out Islands in the 30s, you know, whatever it is, right? That builds, coming back to what you were in episode one, we're talking about the social capital around the community, right? Which is integral to it being a functional community, not just a bunch of people who come in and use resources. It turns it into a network that is actually, it's providing a flow of resources around instead of just being a place to come and suck resources from, if that makes sense. So the last part of this is, for me, is if you move from knowledge, the next level is wisdom, right? So how does the library as a new space provide for wisdom on the individual level, on the community level, And so we got to understand, what do I mean by wisdom? Well, essentially what I'm saying is the realization of the implications of what we know. So you've learned something, you have the knowledge. What wisdom is, okay, what does that mean in the broader context? How does this impact everything else that I know? And therefore, how does it impact how I can act in the world in a wise way? Not just knowing a bunch of stuff, but being able to have intuition that has a positive impact. And I think, again, this is centered around Verveke's work. This is the final point that, and reason this is important to me, is the idea of the meaning crisis. It's something that I've been thinking about for a long time, but generally, if no one has heard of it, what it is that a lot of people in modern society have a lack of meaning in their lives. They have a lack of direction and a purpose for being around, right? And the general argument is that over the last few hundred years, the institutions that provided this meaning, you know, myths, legends, and very, very importantly, and still more important here than in a lot of other places in the West, religion, have provided maybe not a structure of reality that is strictly true, but one that was very useful and gave meaning and direction to people's lives. And that as those sorts of institutions have broken down over hundreds of years, people have not been given anything to replace those evolved institutions. And I think that the library, as newly conceived, could be a very, very important piece of giving meaning to people's lives, of getting connection, being that third space where they can find themselves and others and create meaning moving into the future. So I broadly agree with everything you say. I think that for me, the most important way that this works is through that lens of the four ways of knowing and the broader purpose of wisdom, creating functional community and addressing, therefore, the meaning crisis, which is not as bad here, but from my point of view, it has been getting worse.
I appreciate the context you provided by using the Viveki sort of rubric. I think that's very important because ultimately, purpose is very important. Why we are doing what we are doing, what it is that we intend for the outcome to be. I think that's really crucial before we set out to do whatever it is we are setting out to do. And I really like framing things in that context. So yeah, that's, I'm toasting to the four P's as a framework for imagining our reboot of public libraries in the Bahamas. And I'm toasting it with the Muteki, Mizunari Oak Finish Japanese whiskey, which
and
is
delicious. The famous grouse, which is also delicious, but I look forward to sharing in a beautiful Japanese blend.
Matthew, thank you, man. This conversation was everything that I was hoping it would be. I think it provides a brilliant foundation for when we do have Miss Dorcas on the show. And I'm looking forward to interacting with our community. I know our listeners have already started expressing their thoughts to me on what is being proposed here. So I look forward to a wider discussion, and I think we're doing good work here. I don't know. Maybe it's just me, but that's what I think.
Could be the whiskey.
it probably is the whiskey. Yeah. It probably is the whiskey, my brother. Anyway, have a great week, my friend, and be blessed and prosper. Thank you so much for your time and energy as usual.
Happy to be here. Happy to be able to talk to you, man.
Ladies and gents, that's that over here. Until next time.
Ciao.
Check it out.